We need a good segregation.
Okay, let's let's try and just. I mean, this note at the end, it's a very short piece. It's, in a sense, I mean, I'm not entirely sure how the text was written, but my intuition is that this, the reason it's called an additional note is that, in a sense, it feels to me as though Kozlowski, when rereading what he'd written, needed to give it a conclusion, give it like a summary. And it feels as though that's what this note is meant to do. It's meant to, as it were, point to a particularly complex, difficult issue at the heart of this text. That difficult issue is encountered in various different forms inside thought, inside politics, philosophy, economics, various other spaces. And it says something like the following: if you posit any type of theory in which you explain what exists by an underlying mechanism, then you also are faced with a problem, which is you somehow have to be able to explain how you can explain. And what is the special position from which you can explain the underlying mechanism? In Marxist political theory, this is encountered as what's called the problem of ideology. And this is maybe one way in which you can think about it. Marxists pose a theory in which the economic structure, what they call the mode of production, forms consciousness. It forms the type of thoughts that people have, the concepts they have. It forms the type of thoughts, for example, that money or work is a natural phenomenon. And in fact, these are not natural phenomena, and the belief that they are natural is ideological. Now, in that situation, what ideology refers to is something like an illusion that we live under. So people live inside an ideological situation, in other words, they live under an illusion. Now, for the person who is saying this, they will be faced with the problem of, if A, your explanation is universal, and all ideas are formed by the mode of production, that includes your own idea. In which case, how is your idea not also an illusion, an ideology? And the only answer is to, in some sense, do the following. You can either say, A, I have privileged access to the world. I am a master, in that sense. I master the world because I know it. And difficulty there is that's going to be hard to justify. If you're positing a universal cause-effect procedure at which you somehow can stand outside of it in a what's called transcendent position, it looks like you've got either a sort of hypocrisy at the centre of your theory, or you've got some peculiar additional fact or factor that you need to explain. So that problem of ideology is, you know, how is the ideology of ideology not itself an illusion? How is it, you know, not itself a problem? And the same type of paradoxical problem exists for, as should be obvious, Kozlowski's account of Nietzsche. If Nietzsche says all ideas, all intentions, all meanings are the result of impulses, and we take that word all seriously, then how is the account of all ideas being the result of impulses not itself a mere result of an impulse? How is it anything, in a sense, more true about it than any other idea? Why should we believe this one as opposed to another one? So that's essentially what's at stake in this difficult sort of conundrum, paradox almost. It's not quite a paradox, but it's more like a sort of a self-reflexive problem. Now, you encounter this self-reflexive problem regularly inside philosophy. It's not just in the terms of ideology, it's not just in terms of the ontology of impulses in relationship to intentions. You will encounter this in, for example, the problem of relativism. If everything is relative, then is the statement everything is relative, relative? If it is, then not everything is relative. And if it isn't, then how is it not relative? Well, that's just like the Epimenides paradox. If all Cretans are liars, says the Cretan, is is a lie or a truth. So we have a whole series of these self-reflexive problems that we encounter in philosophy. And at the core of what is going on in Plotinsky's account of Nietzsche is this notion of a self-reflexive problem. The account that is being given implicates itself. Okay? So we need to be careful, we need to be cautious when we advocate the account, because it implicates itself, and in implicating itself, it sort of undermines itself. So this is precisely what we can see in the opening paragraph of chapter 10. In the posthumous fragments, we see Nietzsche reflecting on the substratum of his pathos, an always mobile substratum. This is the impulse. This is what we've, you know, come to acknowledge as the hypothetical ontology, the, as what he calls them earlier in the book, the valetudinary states, the various sort of moods, as it were. Face to face with himself, however, his prospecting makes no claim to master what is moving within him. On the contrary, he seeks to conform himself to the subterranean mobility. So this is the technique that is being posited as the strategy to avoid the self-reflexive problem. Instead of trying to master it, because it's the mastery that will be destroyed by self-reflexivity, I can't stand out of my theory, if my theory is universal, I cannot be therefore master deploying it. Instead of being a master, we try and turn it back around. We try and conform to it. We try and, as it were, learn how to live it. On the contrary, he seeks to conform himself to the subterranean mobility. For no one has chosen to be born as such. The choice was made outside of us. The outside, in inverted commas, we designate as fate. But once he begins to formulate his thinking in order to speak to his contemporaries, Nietzsche turns away from this gaping substratum and almost immediately readopts the everyday habits of discussion, habits that are all based on, quote, the prejudices of the sentiments. By spontaneously readopting the language of these prejudices, however, he cannot avoid developing his own prejudices or treating them apparently as concepts. His discourse, siding with a depth that is incoherent and arbitrary in relation to the intellect, must pretend to defend this constraining coherence at the level of intellectual receptivity. So here is the paradox for Nietzsche. His ontology, a universal ontology, one that says this is how being is, says the following. Everything is impulse. Impulse is arbitrary. Everything is therefore arbitrary. Now, the claim that everything is arbitrary is now faced with the situation of being assessed. Is the claim everything is arbitrary itself merely arbitrary? If it is, what can we do with it? It's just like saying, well, nothing is arbitrary. Something's arbitrary. They're all equal status. Nothing can be done with any of them any more than any other. They're all, as it were, standing before us equally accessible and equally worthless because of that. Nothing prompts us to suggest that we should follow one claim rather than the other. So the difficulty is between this relationship of arbitrariness, which is one of the implications of the ontology of impulses, and the necessity or the power, and those two words are different, but the necessity or the power of the claim that everything is arbitrary. What we need to work out is, can we find a way in which this particular claim actually has a power that isn't arbitrary? From this peculiar ontology of forces in which everything is arbitrary, can we somehow encounter it as meaningful, in other words? Because meaning, and this is why we have a problem here, cannot be arbitrary. If something is to mean something for you and me and the people around us, it cannot mean whatever I want. It must mean something that we necessarily share. If it just means whatever I want, I could use whatever noises I want. I can make whatever sound I want. And obviously, at the point at which I do that, because they're just arbitrary, the very concept of meaning has collapsed. Meaning cannot be arbitrary because it must be a shared necessity.
Can't it be sociologically arbitrary, as in whatever we mean?
It can be sort of sociologically arbitrary, in which case we can push it back to culture, which is one of the things that's precisely going to occur, you know, the idea that there's a code of everyday science. So we can go, well, it's not completely arbitrary, it's, you know, the reason it works is because there's habits. In which case, we can say, well, okay, meaning is therefore just a habit. It's just a way in which we have sort of generated a set of signals that work. Now, what we've done there is we've transformed meaning, which we want to sort of hold on to. We don't want to get rid of immediately. We want to sort of hang on to the power of meaning. Meaning has a power because it seems to have a power of enabling us to understand things. Now, if it has no power to understand things, then it's, you know, it's, because it's arbitrary and it's just a habit, then essentially it's the same as the habits any other animal has. It's the same habit that an animal has when it comes onto heat and shows its arse to the world. That becomes a meaning rather than a gesture, a sign, a signal. It becomes meaningful. Or rather, what we've done is we've taken meaning and we've evacuated it of precisely what we want to find important in meaning, which is that it has the power to enable us to understand things. This is the peculiar power that we want to be able to affirm. Because if we can't understand anything, we are essentially nihilists. We can't create anything because nothing is any more important than anything else. It's just another mode of, you know, making a gesture, making a sign. It's no different, you know, eating is no different from shitting in that situation. Making love is no different from killing someone. There is no inherent meaning or value anywhere. To create value is to create meaning, is to have a certain understanding produced, a certain world, a certain relationship to people around us that we are going to affirm and produce. If everything is exactly the same as everything else, then there is, of course, no value. Value implies higher and lower, better and worse, right and wrong.
I was watching this Jeremy Paxman interview with a stockist and a conceptual artist, and the conceptual artist said everything is, anything can be art. Anything you say is art is art. And but he still wanted to say that there is good and bad art in that, and it's sort of that. Is that the kind of thing that you...
Yes, I mean, the problem we have when we face it with arguments like that is something like the following. Well, you know, if you still want to say, you know, there can be good and there can be bad art, but everything can be art, who is telling me it's good or bad? Who is taking this power? Oh, you, who are the gallery owner. Mm. You, who are the big, rich buyer of art. You're the person with the power. Right. Well, that's no different from the dogmatism of the church saying it has the power to interpret the word of God. You do as you're told. If you're a peasant, you stay as a peasant, and your, you know, wife is given to the Lord on the first day of your marriage to fuck with all you do, etc., and all the other various sort of peculiarities that occur in feudalism. You know, all of which were related to a basis of meaning structured around privileged power. The Enlightenment precisely was a sense in which people with reason could reason for themselves. The power lay inside themselves. It was an empowering movement at that point. And in this sense, this is still trying to grapple with that issue of how to empower ourselves through understanding reason when we encounter the world in this particular sort of... Now, what we are usually taken to sort of understand is that the intellect, as it were, is able to view the world truthfully. And what we have to shift from when we're listening to and reading Nietzsche is we're no longer fascinated by an abstract notion of truth. Nietzsche is now fascinated by a concrete notion of truth. Truth is something that has the power to make a difference. That's what truth is. When we encounter something that has the power to make a difference, we encounter something like truth. And you can think of this very simply. When someone, you know, when you encounter the truth of a situation in your relationship, in your school, in your work, then, you know, if you can, as it were, deploy that knowledge If you can make others see it, then you have a certain power to make a difference. You're no longer subject to someone else's power. So truth is like something that is a power to make a difference.
No.
So Nietzsche is very fascinated by this relationship of analysing powers rather than abstract truths, notions.
But even a lie can make a difference. Even a lie that's persuasive can make a big difference.
Yes, yes,
so right. Therefore, truth is not exactly contingent on itself. It's contingent on certain other aspects, like assent.
What you're calling a lie, you see, is reliant upon an abstract criteria between something being true because it's an accurate representation of reality and something being a lie because it's not an accurate representation of reality.
Right.
So you're relying upon a concept of truth as accurate representation of reality.
Right.
What Nietzsche is saying is, no, that's entirely abstract.
Okay.
Concretely, truth is the representation of reality that has the power to make a difference. So not an abstractly right and an abstractly wrong version.
It's a particular representation that has an effect on it.
And I mean, if you want to think about this in concrete terms, one of the ways of saying something is like, well, is Newton's theory of gravity true or false? Or is it superseded? What would that mean? It's no longer true or false, or is it dodging the question? They push the question harder. You know, some scientist says, well, it's not really relevant anymore. We've got quantum theory and quantum mechanics. It's like, well, is Newton's theory true or false? Oh, well, it's superseded. No, is it true or false? Well, it's superseded. If you look at what they mean there, is they mean you can do a certain amount of stuff, quite powerful stuff. You can get rockets to the moon and put things in orbit with Newton's theory. But you can do more and different stuff with quantum mechanics. So science does not rely upon abstract representation of reality, accurate representation of reality. Science relies upon a notion of truth as the power to do something. If a scientific theory is capable of doing something, then to the extent to which it can do something, it is true. If it can't do anything, it will be false, and it's falsified by being shown that it can't do anything, it can't predict. If it can predict, then it's to that extent true. But we rely upon, in common everyday language, some notion that there's a pure truth. Some, you know, absolutely final, metaphysically clear, adequate representation of reality that couldn't be distorted, and all we've got to do is get rid of all the detritus and crap that distorts it to find this. It's that notion of truth as adequate representation of reality that is precisely given up by Nietzsche, without at the same time giving up the notion of truth. The notion of truth is transformed. So what we are looking for now is a different type of analysis. You're not looking for whether a theory is true or false, by which you mean adequate representation of reality or not. We are now looking at what does a theory do? What powers does it have? The more powers, the more interesting powers we find, the more we might want to say, to the extent that it can do this, it is true. In the same way, we can use that theory to now account for the truth of art. If a piece of art does nothing, then it's not really a piece of art. It's completely no different from, you know, the painting on the wall here. And why is this wall not a painting? It's got paint and it's got a surface. If a painting is just paint and surface, why is that not a painting? Why is that not a painting? Because it's not doing anything. It's not changing anything. It's not altering anything in our perception. It's not presenting anything differently. It's not fiddling with the way in which we see things. To fiddle with the way in which we see things is what art does. It just plays with stuff. And when it works, it's fiddled in such a way that it has implications. It makes other people want to fiddle. It makes other people want to look at it. It makes other people want to stare at it and enjoy it, or, you know, paint it or whatever. So truth must be thought now as some sort of power. So if we begin to think of this idea of relationships of power, then we can begin to understand why we can also see that Nietzsche now no longer wants to master his account of the world, but he wants to conform to it. And this goes back to the thought experiment. What if? How would you live? What if the eternal return is true? How would you live? How would you conform to this thought experiment? Posit a thought experiment. What would happen if you lived like that? And the core of this is this different idea about thought and the impulse. Now, he can begin to pose the question, well, what is it that thinking does? What is it that the intellect does? If it's the result of impulses, if it's some product of impulses, what specifically does this product do? Obviously, trees and the environment and animals and clothes, these are all also products of impulses. Each of them has a different power. What does it do? This is what we're asking. What does it do? What sort of power does it have? The power of the intellect is a power to constrain, to limit, to distinguish by essentially lying to ourselves. It constructs false stabilities so that we can extract powers. It makes concepts, it makes formulas. Now, they're not false in the sense of like they're just incorrect. They are false in the sense that they make no claim to be pure, final, and eternal truths. They are, in that sense, fictions rather than false. This is why he says they are fictions. It's a fictionalization. The intellect is a constraining and selective impulse, he says here, because of its very illusions. It is able to make a difference because it is able, we might say, to tell stories. To tell some stories that are better than others. To tell some stories that remind us of things, connect things together. They constrain, they don't explode, but they bring together. Heidegger called this gathering. So when we encounter the Greeks telling themselves the story of Antigone, what we encounter is not just some soap opera that is meaningless drivel there to make you dumb automata. We precisely encounter a story specifically there to activate the spirit that is a potential in the self watching. In order to activate that spirit that is connected with the intellect, in order to make you think, to make you remember, to make you connect, and possibly in doing so to alter what you're going to do, to alter how you would behave. Now, if it can alter what you're going to do and how you're going to behave, what it's altering is your power. It alters the powers you have. As you learn these stories of ancient mythology, or you learn the stories that philosophy tells about ontology and epistemology, what you learn is not a set of content knowledge claims. What you should be learning is different ways of dealing with the world. You should be expanding and increasing your powers so that you are able to do more than you could do before. That is the point of the intellect. It enables us to do more than we could do before, not by expanding our vision, but by contracting it. By enabling us to focus, in other words, on certain things, rather than have just a manifold of arbitrary, meaningless, and flat surfaces. We now begin to see contours, specific moments, and obviously, we miss things. Necessarily, we avoid and miss things in that situation. But that's fine. There's no problem there.
Do we do this consciously or unconsciously? Is it, you know, the notion, the Kantian notion of transcendental, in a sense that does this happen before I even know about it, or does it happen after?
The idea is, I mean, that's a question that is, I don't think, really...
It hasn't come out in this much.
It's not really, really focused hard here.
It's hinted, though.
But it's hinted at. It's much more explicit, that particular thing in Bergson. Will argue, for example, in something like matter of memory, that the intellect, understanding, thought is specifically a limiting device, by which we might say selective. And in other words, it limits us to what we need. And that's its beginning point. So when we go out for a walk as a primitive human in the forest, we don't just see in some sort of ecstatic miasma of colour and sensation every leaf and tree and contour and flower and grain of earth. You know, what we see are what we need to eat, what we need for shelter, what we need to kill the person around the corner, what we need to defend ourselves. That's what we see. And we change what we can see as we go through our cultures, because cultures are the grounds of needs in that situation. You will learn to see utterly different things if you are doing your Ramir's survival episode than you would if you're going down to the supermarket every day. If you're totally into your survivalist model, then when you go into a field and you look at the edge of the field and you see the little cauliflower line, broccoli line of trees, you won't just see a mass of trees. Each tree will be distinct. Each tree will not only be distinct, some trees will be medicines, some trees will be good firewood, some trees will be weapons, some trees will be spoons that can be carved easily. So they're not just trees, like you city-dwelling people think they are. Every tree has a name, every tree has a spirit, in other words, a meaning. Every tree has a relationship that you have to it. And the same can be applied to just about anything. But every culture has the same thing. People who live in the countryside have no idea quite often how to deal with the various people they might encounter when they get on a bus in London, particularly a night bus, and what to do in those sorts of things. Whether it's a good idea to go downstairs at this point, or whether it's a bad idea to walk past the person who's having some epileptic fit or flipping out their partner, what's going on in front of you. I mean, those sort of things you'll get to use reading almost instantly. You don't even notice anymore when you avoid someone because they look dangerous, or when you go a bit towards them and you curiously keep an eye on them because you think they might look ill. You know, those things almost become second nature to you. Well, of course, if you live in the countryside and you walk into a city, they're not second nature. You're all scary. You're all psychopaths. You're all trying to kill me. That's what it looks like. You know, I come into the city, you're all fucking lunatic. Get away from me. How can you be so close to each other? So the culture that you're in produces that needs, and what essentially occurs is you select from the visions that you see. You don't see everything, because if you see everything, you see nothing. To see everything is to not make any distinctions. How would you even tell the front from the back, unless you're already making a distinction? How could you tell person from animal, unless you're making distinctions? How could you make distinctions unless there was something that was producing those distinctions? And that's the impulses, fundamentally, the bodily impulses Bergson would have called these needs. The reason it's not really touched upon where these come from is because the impulse that Nietzsche is focusing on, or that Klossowski really wants to bring out in Nietzsche, is this impulse to think. That's what's at the core of this. This is what fascinates Klossowski. So I'm going to continue a little bit with this passage. In classicism, or the grand style, which for Nietzsche encompasses the cold gaze of psychologists and Machiavellian despots as well as the rigour of artists, this coherence, the coherence of a master theory, was able to prevail only because it was thought to be guaranteed by the intellect. I am intelligent enough to see through the illusions and lies everyone else is telling you, and I can tell you the truth. So Machiavelli can tell prints the truth of how to deal with people, which is to lie to them. That's the truth of how to deal with people. Lie to them as much as you possibly can. Make sure you lie to the right people at the right time. Make sure you never tell anyone the real truth. Keep everything secret. That's how to be a prince. And I can tell you this because I understand it. My intellect gives me the power of understanding.
And I'm going to share with everyone. I'm going to write a book.
The intellect then was by no means considered to be a selective impulse at this point, but was at the opposite pole of the world of impulses. So in other words, the impulses were arbitrary, just random. The intellect was now somehow a special thing that could begin to control how we dealt with the impulses. But what happens to conceptual coherence when the intellect becomes a mere tool in the service of the unconscious, whether it be Freud, Nietzsche, or Klossowski? Nietzsche's thought relentlessly examines the competition between the arbitrary constraint imposed by the freedom of the impulses. They can interact with anything. They're just random bumps and grunts, and they bump into anything. The freedom of the impulses and the persuasive constraint of the intellect, the latter in turn being defined as an impulse. So for some reason, we are persuaded. For some reason, a story that is being told by someone seems like the truth. It has the power, it makes sense, etc. We might use all these different phrases. Oh, I understand. We are persuaded. We take a position of knowing at that point. But what type of discourse can reconcile coherence with the fact of the impulses? Especially if the impulses are invoked as an end, whereas the producer of the concept, namely the intellect, is used as a tool by this arbitrary incoherence. for we can speak of incoherence only in terms of the intellect. The animal doesn't give a shit about whether you have meaning or not. It doesn't care what meaning you ascribe to it crapping on your table or eating your food or scratching your face. It doesn't dislike you when it spits at you or bites you. It has no meaning attached to that act. You perceive it like that. Quite often, you are unable not to perceive it like that and will hate the animal after it's done that to you.
So there's this episode of Westworld, right, where there's some guy who says, right, there's some project about controlling mind reading. And so they bring in the bloke who's part of this project doing mind reading, and they're talking about MKUltra and all this crap. And then he goes, well, basically, I can look at the way you move around the room, and I can infer from that such and such and such things I said about you. So there's impulses that you put out which don't necessarily look like they mean anything about or how you're thinking or how you're acting, but if you interpret them within a frame, then you can deduce certain reasoning or certain characteristics out.
Right, yeah, I mean, in a sense, that's, I mean, you know, if you call that meaning, the question to ask is, how is that different from an animal that hunts? An animal that hunts and can sniff its prey out.
It's no different.
So, no, it does matter.
Because if I can look at... Okay, go on.
It does matter because what we're trying to do is we're not trying to throw out the idea that meaning somehow has got a power too quickly. We don't want to assimilate it to that which has no difference, to that which is arbitrary. We want to find, in other words, something like the truth of necessity, what the power of necessity or persuasion is. Now, you're right, in a sense we can constantly keep reducing mind reading meaning. NLP, for example, operates like this. We can constantly reduce things, and psychology is premised on this. That's why I hate psychology. We can constantly reduce meaning to nothing more than biology, gesture, technique. But once we've done that, we are faced with a situation of, well, you know, the enjoyment you had of that latest novel or film, the love you feel for your partner, the joy you had in that moment of beauty, all of that is just fucking rubbish. Don't be so stupid. Those are meaningful words. Joy, love, beauty, these are words of meaning. These are not words of impulses or gesture. So when you throw out meaning, you throw out everything that seems to be interesting about the human. Not necessarily specific, but interesting. If we manage to do interesting things, it looks like they're going to be located around this idea of meanings, wells, beauty, soul, spirits, love, joy, you know. If we reduce them to nothing more than gestures, then whilst it may be true that we can reduce them, reduce ourselves as well, we become nothing more than automata. No spiritual structure there. Nothing, you know, in that sense, more interesting living with a human being than living with a cat.
Yeah, but then what comes first then, the spiritual or the automata? Does the actual...
The automata comes first, yes.
The gesture comes first, and then we instill some kind of meaning on it.
Right. Now, the point is we're going to try and struggle, Kozowski thinks, to avoid turning everything into just gesture, just impulse, just automata. But we're not going to be able to avoid that by denying it. We have to, as it were, be able to find the spirit in the machine by encountering the machine in its most machine-like way and constantly searching for that thing that makes a difference, that power that isn't merely an effect or a cause, but that power that becomes a starting point. And this is why the sort of self-fatherhood and the parenthood, it's that starting point we need to become.
It's like finding the beauty in the ugliest moment, or finding the art in the most random moment.
Yeah, in a sense, right, because you're talking about a sort of reversal. That's precisely what we're looking for. But what we're looking for, in a sense, is the reversal point of powers. When we call everything impulses, or, you know, the result of actions, what we're essentially saying is there's a whole bunch of powers in the world that produce stuff. Now, what we're trying to do when we're trying to find the spiritual in the automata is find that there's this other power. We're not trying to say these other, you know, powers A to Z aren't there. We're trying to say now there's another power, A1. And this power is the spiritual automata, the person that can create, the person that can create values or beauty or joy or love, you know, the person that isn't just a biological function, but is now something else. Not radically distinct, they're just something else. We don't have to be dualistic at that point. We just have to sort of say, well, they can do something interesting. But yes, it is a little bit like trying to find, when you sort of find beauty in randomness or something, it's that notion of looking for a reversal point. But here it's specifically to do with this notion of the spirit, which is the intellect, which is thought. Let's just shift slightly onto the next page, because I mean this is the core of this that we'll go straight to on page 197. So he's trying to follow this process through to the source. He's engaged with this problematic of if everything is impulses and why is my thought not an impulse, etc. And one of the ways in which they sort of, Kozlowski thinks that he can begin to produce, as it were, an interesting story, a story that makes sense, is the following. Nietzsche, following this process to its source, thus discovers that of which thought is only a shadow. Okay, so thought is now not even the ground, it's what it's sort of the shadow we encounter. It's the shadow of the strength to resist. How then is the intellect constituted so the agent, supo, is capable of producing only representations? Representations are nothing but the reactualization of a prior event, or the reactualization preparation for a future event. But in truth, the event in turn is only a moment in a continuum, which the agent isolates in relation to itself in its representations, sometimes as a result, sometimes as a beginning. As soon as the agent reflects on it, it is itself only the result or beginning of something else. Every meditation that happens to us is only the trace of something prior, a pre-meditation incorporated into ourselves, namely a premeditation of the now useless acts that have constituted us, so much so that our representations only reactualize the prior events of our own organization. This would be the origin of the intellect's representations. This reactualization, this memory, this reconnection, this way in which we might tell a story about history, etc. But perhaps there is a different origin to the organization that is particular to each of us. Something in that organization has resisted certain external actions. Something in us was therefore able to resist until now, though not at the level of the intellect's coherence. Would this not be a new premeditation of acts to come? Now what this is saying, in a sort of crude way, is that when you encounter this theory of machinic impulses, forces, and you pursue it to its force, one of the things that you're also encountering is going to be why it is you even are able to maintain a sense of self up to this point. Why have you actually had this maintenance? Why have you not, as it were, already broken down into these impulses? Why have you not just disappeared into random, arbitrary behaviour that has no structure or meaning? Why have you not disappeared into just doing as you're told, already being a complete sheep and following the herd? And so the extent to which you've already resisted is the extent to which you have a certain affirmative power of resistance. And this is not itself thought, but it's sort of the real impulse of which thought is a shadow. You try and think, but why are you trying to think? Why don't you stop thinking? Why have you not stopped thinking? Why have you not just gone and done what your parents told you? Why have you not gone and done what the job centre has told you to do? Why have you not gone and done what the bank manager has told you to do? Why have you not gone and done what someone else has told you to do? Why have you said no? And the idea is that even at the very core of being able to say, I am, have a name, you are in a sense saying, no, I'm not nobody. I am somebody is a resistance to being nobody. And that's what it would be if you were just forces. You were just impulses, you'd be nobody. You'd be nothing more than an animal. In other words, you'd have no name. Animals have no names. They don't name each other. They're just an animal. They're just another one. You would be just another one if you were like that. But you don't. You hold your name. Now, if you're going to be interesting, I suggest you start actually naming yourselves. Renaming yourselves. Naming yourselves a particular period you're in. But even the fact that you've held on to the name you were given shows that you've got something that resists just being another one, just being a number, another sort of animal in the pack. So that's the idea that's going on here. At the core of this movement of impulses is the idea that thought is a particular impulse to resist. That's what's underlying thought. Not to find the truth, not to get knowledge, not to do anything, in a sense, other than to resist, which Sartre encountered as well, and formulated in Being and Nothingness as the power of negation. Okay, so that's the way it was generally formulated inside philosophy. Hegel also formulated it as the power of negation. And this was seen by a lot of philosophers to be the sort of core power. Now what Kozowski, Deleuze and Nietzsche are going to want to do is somehow articulate this resistance that you are in a positive way. They do not want to say that it's just a saying no. They want to sort of say that the core of this, whilst it, as it were, is a bit like a child going, no, I don't want to do that, what's the core of that, what's driving the child saying, no, I don't want to do that, is something that it wants to do, but it can't articulate. It wants to do something, but it doesn't even know yet what it is. You can't give it the words. But if we focus on that, what it is it wants to do, we're going to become affirmative, noble. If we just focus on the shadow, the no-saying, we'll get caught up again in slavery. And if we don't do either, we're just a sheep and we haven't even got to the point of thinking. At which point, let someone give you a number, for God's sake, please, because it's a lot easier to deal with you. Which is precisely how you're treated when you're imprisoned or in association with the bureaucracy of the state, is they give you a number, because it's easier to deal with you. Lots of people share the same names, after all. Okay, so, I mean, I would suggest read the last chapter and try and have a look, when you're sort of dealing with the essay, try and have a look at that last chapter as a sort of ground upon which you can produce some critical response to Kozowski. Now remember, the first thing you're going to need to do in your essay is just be able to track for maybe 2,000 words one or two of those threads that we picked out. And just track those threads. You don't have to ignore the others, you can refer to them, but I want you to be able to track a thread and just sort of say, well, it looks like this is what Kozowski is saying. It might, you know, this might mean X, but if we look at, you know, page 34, we can see that it probably doesn't mean that, so it might mean Y. If we look at page 55, we can see that it looks like it might mean Y. Tracking it through, the second stage will be to try and find, well, what does this mean? What does this do? What problems can it be brought up? And then you'll begin to sort of move to, you know, whether there's a successful response to any problem. And this is going to be one of the chapters you're going to need to focus on for like general difficulty that exists with Kozowski's work here. So next week, chapter 2 of Nietzsche and Philosophy, the Active and the Reactive, which is sort of what we're talking about with this idea of resistance. One of the ways in which to think about this active and reactive is to consider that there's a distinction between the ego and the self. Okay? There is a distinction between the ego and the self. And is the ego a slave to the self? Or is it master? That's one of the ways in which to think about, you know, think through. So there's an ego and self, and which is in control, which is master.